A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that is a change of plans from what we announced last episode, only through feeding time. Hey there, this is Cross.
It's feeding time.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
I'm PJ, if I didn't get that across earlier.
Oh, how very exciting. Very fun. Today is our first episode talking about The Last Argument of Kings
New
by Joe
book.
Abercrombie. And what a way to start it. New book, final book in a trilogy, end of the first of three trilogies with like a spare book in there. You know, that's a short story collection. 10 books in total that we've embarked upon. But the beginning of the end, as it were.
Beginning of the end of the beginning?
Perhaps. The beginning of the end of the beginning. I hope everyone had a blast with us last week on the wrap up with Leanna's library. And it was fantastic to kind of get to talk through everything. We talked about a lot of different stuff. So
we were all over the place. That was a lot of fun.
All fucking over the place. Yeah, it was great. I did try to kind of restructure a couple of things in the edit and like try to make it flow a little bit more logically from time to time. Didn't work perfectly, of course, but I hope that you enjoyed the way that it went on the whole and had a good time. It was great. Can't wait to have her back for Best Served Cold.
Best Served Cold. Is that an official announcement now?
Yeah, I put it in the episode.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
she agreed to it in the middle of the episode. So
right. I didn't know if that was like binding.
Well, yeah. No.
As binding as anything is on this show.
Yes, as binding as anything is. Right, right. As mentioned at the very top of the episode, this week we're reading The Poison Trade through Feeding Time. A little bit of an abbreviated thing because we have a bachelor party to go to this weekend. And The section that I had originally was very long and we frankly weren't going to have the time to record it.
You are going to be within like 50 miles of me this time tomorrow.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
That'll be pretty cool.
We'll be in the same state for the first time in a while tomorrow.
Yeah. First time since my wedding.
Yeah, I think so.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Cool.
Weddings bringing people together or something.
Always. PJ, with that, let's kick it off with our quick overview here on what we had happen this week.
Yeah, I remembered to write it this time because Crossland told me I should. Glock dispenser.
It sounds like a manager when you say it like that.
Damn it.
It's been a couple weeks. It's been a few weeks since we've recorded one of these. And
it's all good.
I'm a good employee. Glock dispensed with various members of the Open Council, courting their votes for Salt's favor, only to find a rival in Morovia's little henchman. Dogman and the rest of our merry band of Northmen pull off a scheme to quietly and nearly bloodlessly take Ufrith. Through the siege, West further secures his spot as Burr's right-hand man, keeping Croy and Polder in check and directing men to do work that needs to be done. After returning home to Adjua, Jazal finds himself more out of place than he might have expected. An awkward and bumpy meeting with Artie leaves him feeling uneasy, but he is resolved to make things work with her.
What a political way of putting that, PJ. I'm not gonna lie.
Which one?
Jazal, predominantly, but honestly, all of them.
Yeah.
Great stuff. I'm super excited to talk about it this week. Apologies for, again, the slight abbreviation, but I think we'll be able to do a lot of credence and credit to these chapters this way and not like underdo the rest if we kind of rush them. So I'm glad that we're doing this the way that we are. That said, PJ, how did you feel about this week's reading? You know, like you said, a couple weeks since we last spoke on this. But
and a couple more weeks since I had read anything from this series because we... just recording schedule stuff. So it'd been like a month since I've read anything, and it feels so good to be back in here. I'm really excited.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Well, with that, we will start our little breakdown here. We start, of course, with the very beginning of the book, which starts with a part break. Part one begins with a quote, like they all do. This quote reads, "Life being what it is, one dreams of revenge." A quote by Paul Gauguin. I imagine it's Gauguin because he's French. But in case you didn't know, or for a little bit of background, pretty quick overview, Wikipedia style, because I was unaware. Paul is a French painter, both post-impressionist and a symbolist, born during the revolutionary period in France, from which our title also derives its name in small part. Do you know where the title of this book comes from, PJ?
I don't.
On the side of King Louis the 13th's cannons was inscribed a Latin phrase that means "the last argument of kings," something like "magnum per ratio glorum." I can't remember exactly, but
That's pretty cool. I don't know. That's a cool thing to inscribe on a cannon.
Ultima ratio regium. But yeah, seriously, like what a cool name to like slap on the side of a cannon. And then to start with this sort of quote, it's the first time that we haven't like had that immediate call out to where the title came from within sort of the first segment here, kind of setting it up for like, well, when's that going to show up? Mm-hmm. when's the last argument of kings? So
I'm just thinking about cannons.
Yeah. Cannons ahoy. No cannons in this story, though.
No cannons so far.
No cannons so far. All right. Anything else on the quote? Any other thoughts on sort of where we start there?
Revenge being just sort of a base human ponderance. Makes sense for the story, I think.
Yeah. Do you not dream of constant revenge?
Oh, always.
Good. Just checking.
Every dream I have sure you're has some sort of...
Yeah. Yeah.
Some sort of bit of revenge tucked in there.
My revenge at the moment is on the company Brooklinen, of whom made my sheets, and they ripped last night in the middle. God damn it. I've never had sheets ripped before.
What do you
before.
Mean by in the middle?
In the middle of... Okay. I was not expecting to get into this on the show before we started. But revenge being what it is, I'm dreaming of it, and especially because it's in my bed. That's a separate issue. But like...
Not a whole lot of dreaming going on with broken sheets.
Maybe too much dreaming could be the problem. Oh, and then yeah. I'm like tousling a little bit.
Oh, you have those snaggle toes. Is that the problem?
It's in the middle. It's like at hip height. It's not... Nothing to do with my toes, man. It's literally in the center of my bed. Anyway, it just started tearing. I clearly rolled too much or something, because I'm constantly adjusting the fitted sheet on the side and like putting it back over and putting it under and whatever. Clearly, I rolled too much.
Is your butt made of sandpaper?
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Clearly. I'll send you a photo. Not on my butt, of the bed. Okay, just to be clear. You can see my butt this weekend. So, yeah, I ordered new sheets. I have spares, of course, but like these were my nice sheets that I loved dearly, and they're all ripped up, and I had to buy new ones, and they're spendy.
Did you buy them from same company?
I did. I want a matching set. I'm not going to...
All right, fair. I guess that's fair.
I had them for like
but...
4 years. So like they lasted a long time as far as sheets go.
Yeah, know? That's okay.
Yeah. I think so. How dare thee. All right, cool. Let's get into the chapter here now that we're done talking about my bed sheets. and the dreams of revenge. All right, cool. The poison trade is our first chapter this week, and Glockta's first quote in his internal monologue is one that I personally feel profoundly. I just really appreciate this sort of idea. He says, or kind of repeats to himself when he's thinking about what he does and why he does it. Why do I do what I do when it always hurts me? Why must we test the pain, tongue the ulcer, rub the blister, pick the scab? It's such a nice sort of, I don't want to say it's like sharp in a particular way, but we do find ourselves often as people, at the very least I do, and I reflect on this often, picking at whatever the wound is often more interesting than moving on.
Oh, like, so much fun.
And you should instead it's move so on good. And do the next thing.
It yeah. feels, yeah. I mean, it hurts, but it feels so good to like, my butt hurts right now. I've been doing a lot of deadlifts and just like moving my leg in a way that like stretches it hurts, but feels really good. Like, I mean, that's top of mind because it's today and because we're talking about your sandpaper butt and what it does to sheets.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But yeah, okay. I mean, I think that's a very relatable and applicable little quote there from Glockta.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, yeah, relatable for sure, human for sure. But Glockta is always picking at something mm-hmm. in sort of the human psyche whenever his mind opens up and we see in. And this particular picking is picking at the idea of the human psyche and how we like linger on things. I'm almost intrigued as to why we didn't like, and I guess we kind of do a little bit later, but like the damage that nostalgia causes, and specifically when he's thinking about the women that he's had in his life at the very end of this week, there's sort of a nice, I think, dovetail between these two pieces and parts and thoughts. Maybe we'll get to that when we get to that yeah. portion, but I think there's a nice little thing. Another strong quote from Glockta right off the bat is, you know, where he says internally, "I can be patient. The one good thing about every step being ordeal, you soon learn to tread carefully." Lessons learned.
I think these two quotes together really open this book up in a reintroduction to Glockta's situation physically and mentally and emotionally. Just him in, and every facet of his life is kind of explained by these pair of quotes so far.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We then turn to the business at hand. Glockta is here in Lord Ingolstadt's grand hall to intimidate him into supporting whoever the Archlector deems necessary. He balks at the request, despite being shown a confession, and says that Morovia has already sought his allegiance, threatening his daughters before Glockta's click-tap pains away. His vote is all but secured.
I mean, it's sickeningly satisfying. It's kind of upsetting to say that I'm satisfied by this, but his calm threats that transition so well to like another layer when he learns that threat isn't effective, just man, it sucks, but it feels really good. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's one of those things that it's like, why am I rooting for this guy? We talked at length about that last week. Like, Glockta is despicable in a lot of ways, but damn, is he good. Damn, mm-hmm. is he fun to read.
Yeah.
Threatening people's loved ones with a confession that was obviously elicited under false pretenses, you know, like, come on. Mm-hmm. These threats aren't really real.
Mm-hmm. Tell that to the guy
there
without
may be some
teeth.
Truth to them. Yeah. Right.
Not Glockta,
nice
the other guy.
Grimace.
I'm implying that he took out all the other guy's teeth.
Yeah, he probably did, though.
Glockta has some teeth.
That's a good call.
Useful,
I particularly... You're just mumbling about teeth. I particularly love the name Poison Trade or the Poison Trade. Mm-hmm. I think that it's one of those names, especially for this chapter, that, you know, we often think of Glockta's job as despicable, but he thinks of politics as so much worse. He thinks about it as like the lowest, basest form of engagement in some way, shape, or form.
He's right. But all speaking of the chapter titles, they've all, like, throughout this entire series, they've all been like applicable to the content of the story, but they're so good so far in this story. All of the mm-hmm. chapter titles have been great.
Yeah, and like the occasional internal reference to the chapter title or otherwise, you know, has just been great. But speaking of the poison trade specifically, we then turn to the Archlector's quarters, where they've acquired confessions on everyone who has a vote in the council, and also building out the wall of who's voting for who among the contenders for king. We've got the various contenders. There's like Lord Brock and Isshur in the lead, with Morovi and Salt falling close behind, with others like Barazin and Scald falling behind. There are all these different kind of components and people that are roaming around. It reminds me both of, there's a scene in House of Cards that is kind of like this, but also like Always Sunny, given that it's these torturers and there's sort of a little bit of, I don't know, mishap that abounds in the conversation here. What'd you think of our little war room?
Yeah, I like that you also call it a war room, because that's how I thought of it.
Yeah.
I loved the description of it all and the methods that they use of keeping track of the standings. It felt very cinematic, which is obviously we talk about that a lot throughout this series, but just the bold, multicolored waxes kind of indicating different things or different allegiances. I thought the content of all of the really heinous things that are on the cards did a great job of sort of broadening the understanding of the reach of the Inquisition, and the information that they're able to acquire, the force that they can apply, the fabrication that they can create on all of these high-ranking members of society. We knew they were pretty untouchable, but this is like sort of concrete evidence of that.
Yeah, this really gives sort of the idea that these of the Closed Council are really removed from the entire of the politique, and the politique of the people is smaller and underneath them littler. PJ just finished his cocktail, everybody. We are not even a chapter in.
It is tasty.
Yeah. I agree with you. I appreciate sort of the like high level that we see in sort of these intimidation tactics, and sort of how pathetic Goyle is kind of a nice touch on top of this whole thing, right?
Yeah, fuck him.
Yeah.
All
he knows how to do is kill people.
I've got words for that guy.
I also wanted to note that, you know, maybe this is just a timing and convenience thing, but this is the second time in a week that I've read the word lickspittle, which isn't a lot, but it did happen twice this week.
Yeah. I only read it not once, insignificant. But it did come up in House of the Dragon, I think.
Yeah, you also read it there because it was in High Valyrian, so you had to have read it on the screen.
Okay, so it was reading.
Yeah.
I feel like they've mentioned, I feel like Otto's used it also.
I think he insulted Aegon with it maybe last week.
Yeah.
Which is why there's a little bit of duality there. But don't want to get into the spoilers there immediately for that. We've got a couple of episodes that are out on House of the Dragon. We haven't recorded the most recent two yet. We'll get there, but they're internal in our Patreon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about those eventually. But yeah. Yep. It was just funny that it happened. I was like, what? Wait, what do you mean? Lickspittle again?
Yeah, it felt like because I read or I saw House of the Dragon before I read this, I think. Whatever it was, one way or the other, I thought it was like a made up term in that world. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I mean, I get the point, but it doesn't seem like a real term. And then I read it in the other one. I'm like, wait a second.
It's got to be real. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. It being in High Valyrian, too, is just funny because it's like, oh, High Valyrian has a word for lickspittle. Okay. To kind of round out the chapter here, as the group counts the votes and we get an update on the wider state of the union, Goyle suggests that they contact their friends at the university, to which Salt shuts it down before handing them out their targets for people to acquire votes from.
Goyle is a beady little bitch boy, and I imagine him exactly as Randall from Rocket Power.
I think
I'm thinking of the right guy.
I'm pretty sure.
Kind of twiggy looking, nerdy, like schemey guy.
Isn't that Otto?
No, not one of them. Not Rocket Power, but Rhesus.
Okay. That, yes, now I get it. Yep. I agree. I was like, Rocket Power, that's Randy Rocket, right? Yeah, like, isn't that the guy? Anyway.
No. Yeah. Rhesus, the squirmy little schemey guy.
So Randy Rocket, what a fucking name. I can't believe Jesus Christ. Okay, anyway, Rhesus.
Yeah, just a fucking worm. I appreciate that Salt is basically annoyed with anything that Goyle says throughout this conversation and dresses him down. Makes me wonder why he's still employed here. But, I mean, we're just seeing a small snapshot. Maybe it's a notable sort of high-stress situation from Salt and not typical of how Goyle acts. But I like to think that it's how Goyle always acts and how he's always received by Salt.
Well, yeah, and like you said, like, the killing being, like, his methodology for everything is like, dude,
yeah,
I know that you came from, like, a harsh land, but, like, that's not the only way to solve these problems. Good work on you in getting them solved. We need a defter hand than that, though, you fool.
Yeah. A lot of scrutiny on the Inquisition right now, I think. Play as... I mean, don't play above the board. Like, don't play it straight, but, like, play in the shallow water, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's all of these other things that are going on, right, with, like, the army marching north and, you know, going on Dunbrek, which, of course, we get from West's perspective. There's the Tanner, of whom seems to be citing a rebellion, potentially, out in sort of the surrounding cities and villages. There's just a lot of different things going on, and with so little of, like, the King's Own, there's just so much pressure from the Inquisition, in addition to this balancing act.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to handle for them.
I have a theory on the Tanner based on absolutely nothing, and I don't know why my brain went there, but I have my thought, my bet right now. I'm putting this down as a bet, a very early
cool
baseless bet. The Tanner is a decentralized group, not a singular person.
Okay.
And they are collectively stirring up the masses under the pseudonym of a single antagonist to the crown.
All right. I've got it down. That's amazing. Okay, cool. All right, we'll take that. Mm-hmm. Take and run with it. Cool. With that, we go to our next chapter here. Being Chief.
Okay,
Dogman
approaches. I have a note on the chapter title. Because first time I went through this, I listened. Or I think mm-hmm. I read the first chapter and then like listened for the rest, and I missed the noble business transition the first time, so I thought it was mm-hmm. just one big long chapter with both Dogman and mm-hmm. West, because that's how it's been in the previous book. So I really appreciated the name Being Chief attributed to West as well, but that wasn't the case. So
interesting. Yeah, I mean, there is something there because West steps up in a big way in his chapter, which I think we'll talk about too, but interesting parallel because he does also kind of also like earn his stars to some degree.
Right. Anyway, sorry. Cool. That was a tangent.
No. Good thought. And also, just as an interesting note on that tangent, it makes for a good comparison to compare Dogman and West in that way because they are both inexperienced leaders in their own right. I mean, West has a little bit more experience at this point, I guess, than Dogman does, although Dogman's always been kind of like a leader from behind sort of figure, you know, according to what everyone says. Mm-hmm. So
yeah
and it just adds to that juxtaposition of them and everything that happened with Colonial before. So book had a love triangle kind of
yeah, what I mean,
disconnected triangle.
It's a love angle, I guess.
Yeah, a fawning, perhaps. Cool. So, Dogman approaches three Northmen, guardsmen camped out in front of three trees, city of Uthrith. I just say this as, like, reference to him being from Uthrith, by the way. He's called the Rock of Uthrith. It's not necessarily strictly his city, if that makes sense. Like, he wasn't the Lord. That's not exactly how that works, but anyway, you catch the drift. He sits among them and listens to them chat about the death of three trees and that Dogman himself took his place and how he's thought of as intimidating as hell. I think he says his name in this moment as well as Craig or something like that, as well as a rumor that is being circulated about the Bloody Nine fighting for the Union as well. As the conversation continues, Dow cuts the throat of the boy and Grim slides his blade through one of them while Dogman pounces on the third and stabs him three times.
Through the ribs. I loved all this rumor and bluster, and I couldn't help but laugh at, I mean, it's a game of telephone. It's things get exaggerated, stories get told, things get bigger and bigger and bigger, but particularly loved the fact that Dogman got his name by biting some woman's tits off.
Yeah, like, what?
No mention of his incredible schnoz.
Just
some pervert that bit a woman's tits off.
Yeah, it just goes to show that, like, the named men thing, how much of it is true and how much of it isn't, and how much of it is just, like, whatever, you know?
It's effective, though. Like, despite being wrong, it's still...
It's still a myth, yeah.
Well, and the whole point is to be intimidating. And, oh yeah, that dog man, the leader of this crew, really good at smelling stuff. Isn't as intimidating as, like, he's just like, he's a fucking dog. He's a fucking wolf. How like savage he is in attacking.
Yeah.
So, like, it makes sense that the name becomes something that it wasn't intended to be in stories told.
Mm-hmm. Totally. It's so exciting because it also, some of the mythology for other names and other people, we're kind of seeing build out around us. And the reason I say that is Black Dao earns his name here, not once, but twice in this very moment. I mean, A, he's the one who agrees and slits the kid's throat, right? But then on top of that, he doesn't kill him at first blush. And so then he stamps on him until he dies. Yeah. Black Dao indeed.
Black Dao indeed.
Yeah. There's the quote that he says at the men as well while they're sitting there. And once you've got a task, you best do it right, which is close to Logan's aphorism. Yeah. It's not quite what it is, but it's not wrong. Not wrong.
No, I don't know if he could. He's got a brain on him, but it's not a very good one.
You mean Dog Man?
Oh, I meant Dog Man? Black Dao.
Oh, Black Dao. Yeah. No. Yeah. Dog Man's the one that says that.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
Black Dao's.
Yeah, Black I mean, Dao's. he's got to make his own. He's got to make his own phrases. He can plagiarize a little bit, but
yeah. I love the quick catch up here that we get with the men and Dao's note on it being a cold night before he takes a drink after doing just the dirtiest business, as mentioned, with the kid and otherwise, like, yeesh.
It's pretty fucked up. But
mm-hmm.
Not many warm nights in this line of work, especially with Black Dao.
Yeah, I think it shows the smallest tinge of remorse. Maybe remorse is the wrong word, but like smallest tinge of
I think it's
humanity,
coping.
Maybe.
I think it's a little coping. Bit of coping with what he, like the position that he's carved out for himself within this group.
Mm-hmm.
Like he does the dark things that need doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely his place among everything. Shortly thereafter, that moment in kind of our catch up with Grimm and Dao, of which Grimm is hilarious over the course of this chapter and is talking a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
one would say a lot a bit more, although that doesn't mean that he's talking a lot.
Right. It is a lot a bit more. It's a good 200-300% more than the rest of the series.
yeah, exactly. But shivers until Duru's quiet raid on the city begins as the Carls take the city. All of the different named men are kind of pointed in different directions. They are quickly prepared to burn down the buildings, although nothing is lit or ready to go. They surround all of these various important bits. Dogman whacks on the bell, of which Grimm was kind of pointing out, letting it ring as the city wakes up. Yeah, never waste a bell. And they run to the sound. Dogman pulls from his time with Three Trees and speaks confidently to the town's headmen, who surrenders in earnest before the Union's imminent arrival to take Ufrith.
Oh, I love seeing Dogman in this position. I think he's really, really finding his own. He's learning what face he needs to put on. He's very thoughtfully borrowing from both of his former chiefs. Chiefs? Would it be chiefs, the plural of chief?
I think it's still chiefs.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I just think chiefs is a funny word. but Dogman, it's been a few months, it seems like, since the end of the book, or end of Before They Are Hanged. So he's had some time off page to sort of build his confidence, and I think he's really coming to his own as a leader. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It is great. It's also great that kind of Grimm plays off him more directly. I would say almost as his second. I'm not sure if that's 100% the case, but him being the one that you know, Dogman looks to like finish his sentences in the same way that Dogman finished Three Trees is, I think, just a little heartwarming
it
for
is.
Me.
Especially it's weird. It's weird that it's heartwarming, mm-hmm. but it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice little moment. Of course, again, they agree to surrender. They drop all the various weapons, including like the crude instruments that they were planning on maybe fighting back with, settling in. And you kind of get the sense that maybe a lot of people don't really care for Bethod's rule as well. Like they're more okay with this than it would appear. But there is a final moment in confrontation with a woman of whom is looking for her son. And I think that this is a good casual reminder of the cruelty of these characters exert and sort of the necessity there. But actually also how this is still cruel no matter which way you slice it. And it certainly cuts up Dogman in a way that is certain to wound him. And like he says at the very end of the chapter, after all, it ain't easy being chief.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to not think about, like, in this sort of thought process, not think about the alternative. Like, they were posted up. They were guardsmen. They were, like, if things came to a fight, that kid would have fought. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't have been very good at right. it. Still would have died right away. Probably a more gruesome death. But you have to face the consequences of it all the same. And see his mother crying out for him. Not easy.
No, not at all. And that, again, sort of that baseless cruelty is just a reminder that, like, we cheer for these people, the things that they do in a lot of different ways. But it's important to remember that, again, most of the people are very bad.
Yeah.
that we follow and that we like.
I don't know if I'd call it cruelty, even, given the circumstance. Like, it might kind of feel like it, but the alternative
it's necessary,
is more blood.
But it is a cruelty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. You're right. The alternative is worse in a lot of ways. But that's like, that again, that's why necessary cruelty, mm-hmm. necessary evils, right?
Yeah.
But accepting necessary evils is like it's a rocky road to go down.
Right.
Cool. All right. With that, we go to the noble business. We return finally to West at the very end of the Siege of Dunbrecht. Like you said, it's been a couple of months since we've seen most of our characters. Obviously, as we get in later, like they've fully made the return back to Adjua. Everyone has had some time to kind of rally between pages here. And the Siege of Dunbrecht is an incredibly grisly affair. Its bodies piling slowly as the water drives them closer to the White Flow. We get a description as well as to Croy's efforts during the siege. In this sort of multi-layered affair, the brutality, all of the people that died, the boiling water poured on people as they got close, the hacked and slashed, thousands dead, that ends in a grappling hook and a stealth mission that culminated with the fall of the inner fortress with the loss of a single man. It's just sort of like the futility of the front-facing war is so crazy versus mm-hmm. anything else.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah.
It's a fucking grueling situation. And a single Union life, and I think they say it's all over in like 10 minutes. Like,
yep, 12 men, 10 minutes, one life.
Yep. Pretty incredible. Yeah, this whole intro section to this chapter is telling and really cool. A lot of, I don't know if I call it action. It's not really action, but it feels like action. Like the energy of action is teeming in this section.
Yeah, I would say especially for the first law, there's a good bit of summary here to get us through sort of the occurrence. And it is like action driven summary as like he describes the falling arrows and all of the various water and implements that were used to defend the fortress like an old medieval fortress siege in a lot of ways. This time kind of from the other perspective as opposed to seeing it from, you know, Dagaska and protecting, you know, it's important to think of, well, they probably had their own internal council that was making their own calls to protect in a similar way to the way that Glockta did. And mm-hmm. all it took was time and effort. And these things happen over and over and over again.
Yep.
So as they make it inside, there is a coterie of corpses hung inside the walls of each of the towers, cut with a bloody cross, and their offal hanging out. Three of their heads missing, perhaps the heads that were sent back before as gifts. Regardless, West is offended by the whole affair and offers 10 marks to any man willing to cut them down and bury them in this as this sort of like strange you know, rotting bodies and corpses and perhaps a ritual or whatever, you know, just the weirdness that is these people left in the buildings.
I assume that those three headless bodies were the three that we saw previously. Don't know why else.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes the most sense to me, but this whole situation is pretty fucked. At first I thought it was a warning, but it doesn't, that doesn't make sense to me at like further thought of like, why would they put a warning somewhere they were occupying? Then I go into thoughts of, I don't know if I want to call it conspiracy, but understanding that the Shanker are in league with them, is this something that leads to the creation of more Shanka? I don't know. That's a bubbling thought at the moment.
Okay.
But fact that they're so decomposed that even West is like slow to recognize them as corpses. They've been there for a long time. I don't know, man.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, you know, that event happened back in the Blade itself, which is important to catalog as like at least a year ago, I think, given kind of the rough time scale of things.
Like that. Yeah.
If not a little bit longer. It's so they've been hanging in there a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we then move from sort of this horrific, grisly scene after scene, in all honesty, for the most part, West's scene has just been trauma after trauma after trauma, to a briefing with Croy, Polder, and Burr. Burr seems to be shrinking by the day, but also hasn't shirked any of his responsibilities, including leading his generals. They harry each other with words for position, but both Burr and West dissuade them on their thoughts that they single-handedly captured either city that they're responsible for the sieges upon, including Ufrith and Dunbrack in these two cases. All in all, the path before them leads to the north proper and another big siege to come, as no one has invaded the north since King Casimir. It seems like we have reclaimed Angland at the moment, given the sort of path.
Yeah, seems like it at least. West jumping in and letting them know what's what, sort of outlining the work that the Northmen did, was delicious. After the sort of, I can't remember if it was Croy. I think it was
Polder, because Croy did Croy, this siege.
Yep, Croy was. I hope there's more dressing down of these two like knuckle fucks in the future. Fuck these guys.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very funny. I think one of my favorite parts about this is an internal quote that happens from West where he says, "The two generals still appeared to regard Bethod and his Northmen as minor distractions from the real enemy, each other." And that's just delicious.
There's another one. There's another quote. I think it might be like one of the last sentences of the chapter, but Burr mentioning that it's not a competition and the two competing to agree the hardest. Like,
yeah. Ugh.
Just despicable. It's kind of despicable. Just gross people.
Oh, man. Yeah, super gross people. And honestly, a strong chapter from West, another like short one in which we get a lot of this sort of like reintroduction rolling in. I love, again, that this is called This Noble Business. I appreciate the being chief perspective, but just repeatedly like seeing that like war is grisly, war is bad. You know, the results of war are terrible. The consequences are long reaching, and the people of whom are fighting at the top for the power to order this sort of grisly business aren't better than squabbling kids, you know, and that's reality, folks.
Ooh.
Yeah. Pretty brutal, all told. All right. Anything else on West?
I don't think so.
Cool. All right. With that, we'll go into our drink segment. PJ, what are you having this lovely evening, afternoon? It's like 5 for you.
5:30 evening. I think evening works. What I had.
Right. Because you finished it at chapter 1.
So I have been kind of obsessed with the Infante that I had 3 of them on our wrap up, and I've just been wanting to kind of riff on that even more. So Kaylin had a bottle of grapefruit juice So, and I bring it up as a bottle of grapefruit juice because I think it's important. So I wanted to try to make that same drink, but instead of lime juice with grapefruit juice, and it just wasn't bitey enough. And I think it would have been if it was fresh squeezed grapefruit. I think it could have worked, but it was too much on the sweet and not enough on the tart side to begin with. So I added a squeeze of like an eighth of a lime and worked out really, really well. My goal was to make something, as I had said before, it was kind of an analog or like a very pared down margarita. This, I was going for the same, but with a Paloma, and I think it worked. I'd really like to try it with fresh grapefruit juice because I think it would work really well. I think I'd still probably add the lime. But for anybody who didn't listen to the wrap up or didn't listen to the drink segment or whatever, or doesn't remember.
How dare you, eh?
Infante, it is 2 ounces of tequila. I used a Reposado tequila. 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice traditionally, but obviously I used grapefruit juice. And 3/4 of an ounce of orgeau, and then 3 drops of orange blossom water, all shaken. Oh, I also didn't garnish it with nutmeg. That would have been good too. Forgot about that part. But regardless, very refreshing. It's a sweet, citrusy, very simple cocktail. And I truly, like, I don't know why I haven't heard of this before, because it's so fucking good and I'm going to make them all the time. Cross and I were talking before that I think we're going to make like a big batch of ingredients for it and bring it up to the bachelor party this weekend. It's just so good.
Of spirits, right?
Yeah.
Like that's it worked all you well need is the orgeau and then whatever
Blanco
spirit.
Tequila worked well with Reposado, worked well with rum. I'd like to try it with, I think gin, vodka could probably work. Vodka might be weird. Like I don't think you'd get, I don't know, maybe it'd be fine. I'd like to try it with Irish whiskey, though. I think that'd be pretty good. I want to try it with a bunch of different spirits. I think it'd be fun. But that is that. My back half beer, which I'm already sipping on, is called Wedding Season from Blackstack Brewing Company in collaboration with Weldworks Brewing Company.
Cool.
Weldworks.
They've done a lot of collabs.
Famous for Juicy Bits, which is a wonderful
favorite,
prototypical New England IPA. And Blackstack is, I think, the best brewery in the state of Minnesota. So really great double IPA from those two breweries.
Cool. That's exciting by all accounts. PJ, you're talking about the Infante. I have had sort of a, I made an Infante this weekend. I had a bunch of family in town since we recorded the Leanna episode. And I was kind of playing with it and spinning with it. I watched a How to Drink episode a little bit earlier today while I was writing up some contracts for work. And he made a spin on the Rusty Nail. And I was like, I wonder if that would work in play with the sort of thing that we were doing with the Infante and kind of playing around with it. So I kind of made a gin Infante with a little bit of a spin on it is sort of the way that I've been thinking about it. It reduces some of the ratios, but we'll talk about that in a second here. So I'm calling it the Three Heads, and I'll get to why in a moment here, or the Three Gifts, whichever you want to call it. What it is 2 ounces of gin. I put 1/4 ounce of Saint Germain in it. I would either remove the Saint Germain entirely or sub it in for either yellow or green chartreuse. It needs a little bit more herbaceousness. This oversweetened it a little bit. I added an extra bit of absinthe into it to counteract that. It worked great. It tastes really good. But St. Germain was a little much, even at 1/4 ounce. But 2 ounces of gin, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, 3/4 ounce of orgeau, a dash of Peychaud's, a dash of Angostura, a dash of absinthe on top after it's shaken. So basically getting all those core spirits incorporated, pouring it out, and then adding a dash, Peychaud's, Ango, absinthe. And then I garnished it. I say garnish obtusely, as you know, one might do with three heads that they're sending to their enemies, revenge and all that. So I know that it's a lime drink and I did squeeze limes, but I put a lemon peel on the edge because fuck you, I guess.
All right.
So Yeah, it's delicious. It's really good. Like I said, the only thing I would probably change is either remove the Saint-Germain entirely or add that yellow chartreuse. This is made specifically with Momentum New World Gin. They sell two different kinds of gin, Old World and New World, which is interesting as a format of being like, this is sort of your London dry style. This is sort of your more modern American style gin. So very, very interesting production methods.
That's cool. There. What would be the, how would you break down the differences between the two?
So like London dry or like navy strength, right, is like a little bit more boozy and going for those like woodsy notes and like all of those other kind of components that I would consider, you know, like Bombay Sapphire or like Tanqueray to have, you know, there's sort of, that's sort of what I would ascribe to Old World. New World, I would put in like the category of aviation where it's meant to drink very clean, crisp. You're still getting those elderflower notes and everything else, not elderflower, but you're still getting all of those other notes, but you're not getting them over the top or bitter or in your face.
Okay.
They're more subdued. I think New World in general is more subdued.
Yeah, I like gin. I've never really dove super deep into it, so I'd like to learn the differences more.
I love gin. I haven't had enough gin on the show lately, so that's part of the reason I bought it this weekend, because I was like, you know what? I would like to play with some gin, and I haven't in a while. So
nice.
That said, I need to get like yellow chartreuse or something else to play with, because I could do like Campari, but that's going to overpower and blow it out. And I was like, huh, with a rusty nail, you call for Drambuie to back it. And I was like, I don't have Drambuie. So then I was like, what do I do? And just, I was like, splash a Saint Germain and then, you know, rock everything else. And I was like, eh, but again, yellow chartreuse, I added three dashes of absinthe to compensate for the Saint Germain. And that was enough to blow out the Saint Germain and make it disappear.
All right.
So.
So I think it's worth noting part of the reason why I found this cocktail, and then you and I both have kind of leaned into it pretty heavily. It very heavily features orgeau, which generally uses a very little bit at a time. But if you look up Anders Ericsson on YouTube, you can find a great episode where he does a bunch of different syrups, and orgeau is one of them. It's got a super easy shortcut to making homemade orgeau. Instead of blanching your own almonds, it just uses unsweetened pure almond milk as the base, and that makes things so much easier. But
yeah, which is what both of us do, I think.
Yep.
We're both on that train.
Yeah, I've never made it with blanched almonds. Like, I've never blanched my own almonds.
Sounds like so much work.
I know Tim, I know our friend Tim has.
Yeah,
I don't know if
it's, as back half beer. Instead of a beer, PJ, I am having an Old Fashioned made with Momentum's first single barrel bourbon. So they start making bourbon. This is their first release. I've bottled 54 out of 250. So, or 55 out of 250. So
cool.
It is a delightful bourbon. It's only aged 3 years, but it is still so good for a young bourbon.
Nice.
Yep.
Yeah, I need to get some more bourbons. It's been a while since I've had anything new.
After the call out last week of not drinking whiskey on the show, I'm just like conscious of making sure that we have some kind of whiskey every once in a while.
Have some more representation there.
Yeah. All right, cool. With that, let's go to the new man. So we pick up with the end of our not so merry band of folks from the edge of the world sailing back into Adjoa. We get one last saying out of the lovely brother Longfoot, to which Baez retorts, knocking him down a peg before we also have Logan and Pharaoh separating angrily, despite them wanting to be together.
Man, for a little while, for a couple sentences, I was really holding out hope that they'd stick a little bit more together and just a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Fucking way she goes, man.
Rip. I mean, and he didn't fight too hard either, so there's
nobody
that,
did,
you know. Nobody did. Nobody liked this either. Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, particularly of course the quote that comes afterwards, which is, say one thing for Logan, nine fingers say he's got the touch with women, which is,
I don't think I'm gonna say that about Logan Nine Fingers right now.
I believe that's what he said. I believe he said that in the last book as well, and then comes back to that as sort of like a ringing endorsement of like, clearly I've got the touch with women. Who am I to think I do? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At least he's self-aware.
Yeah, incredibly self-aware. And like, it's just kind of, it's a tragedy, I think, of this original trilogy, which is to say that like, I think near misses like that happen all the time, right? Like, it's not uncommon for, you know, something like that to occur. And it's just kind of sad in its tragedy, glad that it happened, but sad that it's not anymore, you know, kind of a thing. Yeah. Rip the angry couple.
The angry couple.
I mean, what else? What else am I going to call
it? Yeah, it works.
So I particularly appreciated Jizal's shifted perspective here as we return to Adjua on this boat, coming to understand more than his small slice of the world. He almost resents Adjua and its people as he returns, preferring that smaller life to the bigger one he'd spent most of his life aspiring to in some ways. And I particularly of note, I think I appreciate that it mirrors Pharaoh's perspective of the city when she first arrives, or Logan's. It is very similar, starkly so.
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on. I really, really like that. He spends quite a bit of time, or he focuses quite a bit on the fashion and trends and how they've evolved since he's left. And I'm curious if the changes are truly as dramatic as he's made them out to be, or if he's like looking for things that are different and exaggerating them to himself. I don't, I think he, or just hadn't taken the time to notice the oddity of style and of fashion and the things that are not, which he's.
Yeah. I feel like it's the latter. I feel like he grew up and aged a lot, you know, by leaving the city. I'm with you on sort of that, but I think it more clearly represents the latter, sort of the ridiculous ostentatiousness of it all.
Yeah. The impracticality of it. Or I guess it's not impractical, but the lack of practicality. I guess that's the same thing, but I feel like there's a little bit of a distinction.
I can see a little bit of a distinction in what you're saying. I think that it is, lack of practicality is mostly correct, or impracticality of it all. But also, like, this isn't necessary. There's no part of this that, like, this rat race isn't worth running. And I think that's really the sort of feeling that I got more or less from this. And it's something that I've fully sunk myself into in my own way, where it's like, I used to care so much about all of those kinds of things. And as you get exposed to more and more, and as you like actually age and mature and develop, those things start to like fall by the wayside in terms of their importance. It's good to look good, don't get me wrong. But the rat race of like, what is the sort of trend here? What is this? What is that? Is just, you know, for some people, they absolutely love that. That's good for them. Personally, I side more on the Jizal side of things of like, not worth it.
The newfound
Jizal side of things. I'll stick with my bands. Thank you. Yeah, right. Yeah, he's breaking free of that old impression that we had of him that was pointed out. So, oh man, Jizal in this moment, as they're kind of walking through, he is almost immediately bothered by a woman who's being harassed by a group of watchmen for being poor. And this is, I think, another big thing where he sees this injustice and immediately is like struck with something, as before he kind of looked upon the impoverished and even anyone of lower class, and like didn't care or even insulted them in his own monologue. He really has grown a little bit here. It's such a strong showing from, I'm gonna say it, our boy proper. I think at this point he's escaped somewhat, or mostly, the sort of nepo bigot perspective.
I think you're right. He even says in this exchange that he's always been disgusted by the poor or something like that. Like, it's a pretty definitive and bold statement that he makes to himself about it. But it feels fairly clear that Baez is manipulating some strings here. But
you think?
Oh, yeah. But what's great to see is that those emotions do live inside of him. Like, maybe not big enough to act on his own, but they're there. Like, I don't think Baez, as far as I can understand, he can't, like, implant emotions inside of people or thoughts inside of people, but he can, like, draw them out. So, him having some anger towards this and having these feelings being drawn out by Baez, it's something. It feels good for him to react this way.
It feels better than it may have any other way. So yeah, there is something there for him at the very least, and that's a good thing. I'm pleased with our boy, by and large, especially in this moment. It is notable, like you said, of course, that Baez kind of loudly proclaims that Baez or Giselle is doing the right thing. Look on, everyone. Giselle, the champion of the contest, is helping out a poor woman. It's just a lot of like specific fanfare that Baez lays on really thick.
So fucking thick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the response from the crowd. He's like, the contest, he says.
It's very comedic.
It's so good.
Making friends with the people. So Giselle departs Baez and Pharaoh, and this is sort of like no part of it is sweet. It's mostly bitter, but there's a word exchange between the two of them that sits with Giselle that I think Baez says, we will collaborate soon, or something like that. That's like very just grating on him. And he's like, what do you mean collaborate? But first, he makes a quick stop back at his home and at the park by which we originally met him and saw him. He stops to and sees and notices his old gambling chair and table. There's sort of moss growing on it. It's been undisturbed for a long time, of course. And there's this sort of reflection on the nature of what he would do if his friends were back, or the way that he would play a hand or two still, but it wouldn't be the same, right? And he kind of like just reaffirms that in himself, being like, I've changed. I've really like developed here.
Yeah, I do a bump or two of coke, but I'm not a coke addict anymore.
It'd be just for fun. I wouldn't make fun of them. I miss Brint. I miss Jalenhorn. I don't. What's the other guy's name?
West?
No, not West. The other lieutenant. I was playing that off like Giselle didn't know, but also I don't remember, so it worked out for me.
It's Oh shit. I shouldn't have brought this up. The other one.
The other guy. I'm sure someone's gonna comment immediately on this, being like, oh, it was this guy. But yeah.
We don't remember. Giselle doesn't Caspa. Either.
Caspa. Nah. It's Caspa. That's his name. Fair enough. Caspa doesn't count.
Dead in the ditch somewhere. Back to the mud.
Perhaps. Back to the mud with Caspa. Oh, no. But he decides to head to Artie's here and makes his way there first before he settles in to do anything else or like find his heading from Veruze and what he's to do next. He finds himself uncomfortably spinning about what he's going to say to her first, even repeating one of Logan's many aphorisms to himself. Better to do it, better to do it, better to do it, than better to do it than live in the fear of it. So good. Eventually, he knocks on the door, talks with the servant, and then is greeted by Artie quickly, and his heart races suddenly, and I almost want to say, like, thickly in a way. Like, he gets that, like, sick to his stomach feeling. And, you know, like, that like, love makes you feel it's very real. It's very tangible on the page. I love it. Joe does such a good job describing it. But she states that she heard of his exploits from her maid, as his story has traveled fast and in front of him in a big way.
Yeah. So first things first, I love his stressful but careful planning on what to say, like the methodical planning of how to like present himself when the door gets answered, and he goes out the fucking window, and he goes with the first thing that he went with, which was just, I have returned.
Which is not the good one.
Not the good one. He recognized it as not the good one and then like backpedals immediately, but it was perfect. Super fucking funny. Man, I can't help but think that there's magic around every corner. And I'm suspicious that, like, obviously Baez's proclamations did a good job of, like, disseminating the information about Giselle, but I'm curious if he also, like, pulled on the emotions of the people that heard him and got them to spread the information more than they normally would have naturally. I'm also like scrutinizing Artie for some fucking reason. It gets to it later, but when she starts like biting, I'm like, oh no, she's a fucking eater. Like, this is not Artie. And, I mean, that gets just like that. I'm no longer scrutinizing her in that way, but like, my brain's all over the fucking place right now.
Yeah, it's difficult to map some of the individual things here. So I definitely understand there's a lot going on by all accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I love your sort of skepticism of the whole thing, especially love.
Yeah. Artie likes to bite, though. Like, this isn't the first time.
He bites a lot. Yeah.
He bites a lot.
Yeah. And hard, apparently. Like, all right. Bleeding is a lot, you know, and like if someone else's tongue is swimming around in your mouth and you're bleeding, like, kind of gross.
Or you're into it and that's cool, whatever. Like,
totally fair. This is my perspective.
Maybe discuss
blood's
that.
A little gross.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe discuss that ahead of time. Giselle might have been, please don't. What is it? Please don't. That would have had the conversation even a little bit ahead of time. She walks past him very closely and very tensely, as Joe describes it, almost like going in for a kiss, but then sliding past to the cabinet behind to her one true love, the bottle. Just kidding. But she breaks out a decanter.
Not kidding that much.
I'm not kidding that much, actually. Well, it's because she is forced to not do a whole lot else. So there's something there. I don't fully blame her. But she pours herself a glass of wine and says that she thinks she sees a change in Giselle, outside of his obviously not quite the same jaw, and speaks of how frequently Wes writes her and of surviving a battle within the last month. And so she's aware of sort of his status and place, kind of catches him up on the current events of like Ladislaw dying, Degoska falling, the war there that's happening, the war on two fronts that's occurring. And the news just keeps coming to him in waves as to each of these individual happenings, the two princes having died. And he sees these things as pretty small trifles, considering the thing that he's been through. He's like, I don't care about the world. I don't care about all of these things. I know that they're a big deal. But at the same time, he stops dead in the middle of this and says, I've been a fool all my life. Not now. There were times out there on the plane. The only thing that kept me alive was the thought that I might be with you again. Every day I wanted to see you. But it falls flat of what he wanted to say as she kind of retorts and rebuts in the moment. And
yeah, she
what
just
a beautiful
kind of scowls at him.
Yeah. Him being like genuine and sweet.
Book fucking got me, though.
Fucking gets me every time, dude.
No. Just immediately after this, like I got by like his proposal, which is like the next sentence.
And it is.
It's just a dirty fucking trick from Joe.
It's especially a dirty trick on the page. Like it's definitely a dirty trick in audio, right?
Yeah.
But it is a dirty trick on the page because it's in quotes and you're reading
exactly.
That early.
It's in quotes. It's not italicized. Yeah. It's not the way that like Glockta's inner monologue is denoted. Mm-hmm. Like it is a straight up quote and it fucking got me.
Or at least that's what he wanted to say, or something like that. It ends with it. I'm like, no,
yeah, it said that's what he wanted to say, or something. Yeah, man, I might have it up here still right now.
Yeah,
I bought it on Kindle again.
Nice.
He almost said it, but at the last moment, he saw a scornful sneer and he stopped himself. Like,
that's true pain. That's real pain.
That's dirty.
Yeah,
I was so excited for the briefest half second.
Me too, man. It's one of those things that drives me absolutely bonkers inside of this. It's like, I, you know, do what Logan said. But there's a confrontation that we have to get to here that kind of rounds out this in a weird way and kind of, I don't know, we'll talk about kind of more about the end of this chapter here, the way that we feel about it. But lovely quote, lovely interaction that goes sour because everything goes sour. Nothing is good. Expectation is bad. Joe almost explicitly says expectation is bad coming up here in a moment, but
yep.
Cool. So this moment leads to a rough and tumble sexual encounter that Artie has patiently waited for. As she says, we've already made mention of the intense lip biting that happens. Giselle repeatedly saying no to advances, but then being into it in the end. It's quick. It's effective. It's efficient. Bending Artie over the table like over an old man as it squeaks like or something like that.
Bashing her head against the plaster.
Right. Giselle's in character monologue for this moment is so bad. He's like, he imagines an old man. Are you fucking kidding me, dude? It turns the otherwise like incredibly romantic thing that we've been spending the last book into like an utter baffling moment, and that's also so real. Mm-hmm. Like, again, it just is what it is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's anticipation from both of them that just mm-hmm. falls flat.
Fizzles. I'm not sure. I don't know what to read out of Artie's take on that, if that makes sense. I don't know. What did you make of sort of Artie's response? Maybe here, I'll finish the thought and we can just talk about the whole chapter, because there's a lot to kind of go over here. We'll finish up the like summary-ish of the thing. But he tries to comfort her, of course, says that he loves her, but she reacts in a way that many an abused person reacts, by demeaning, saying that she's nothing, you know, not self-aggrandizing, but sort of, you know, self-deprecating, of course. He continues to profess his love for her, although he thinks internally that this might all be a lie, but he's gone too far to turn back. He comforts her, pulls her close, and promises that nothing's changed.
It's all messy, and it's not the immediate spark that he was expecting when he returned. But I think he got the right idea with how he's responding here. That, like, what I took from this is that it'll take some consistency and being there, and hopefully that'll go a long way in fostering the relationship that he's envisioning. And I don't think he thinks he's lying. I can't remember the exact quote, but he says it feels like a lie.
He says
it feels like a lie when he says it, but I don't think it is a lie. I think there's just like conflicting emotions, and it's not exactly what he was anticipating. So it's like fighting with
tasted him. Like lies. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think he's lying to himself.
I think he's uncertain.
Yeah. I think there's just a tumultuous feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got the right idea. I think it'll just take some work. And I think that's reality. So I don't know. I think Artie.
Yeah, returning to Artie's perspective.
Yeah, going back to her, she is, despite the bold face that she puts on, she's pretty timid. She's pretty reserved. She, like, in the way that she doesn't like want to commit super hard to something. Like, she'll take what she wants when it seems like it's going to go away, as we see here. But she's not going to be the first one to act unless she absolutely needs to. So, like, I think it's a timid sort of deal, despite her bold presentation of herself.
I think it's vulnerability.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah,
I think it's her actually being vulnerable. I understand exactly what you're saying. I just view it personally as a moment of her actually breaking down, because she hasn't, right? And this is the first time that she hasn't been all put together with Giselle. This is the first time that she hasn't been aloof and distant and otherwise. It's not to say that she requires him by any means to feel whole, but at the same time, it can feel good to confide in someone else in that way. And she has decided in some facet or capacity that this is her guy. This is the guy that she is intentionally waiting for. This is the guy that she likes, even though she thinks that she doesn't deserve it for all of the reasons specified previously, the parental abuse, the sibling abuse, everything like that in her life. And like even just culture and society preventing her from, you know, like getting even out of this house more often than not. It's all just a lot of pain and self-doubt. And so this one thing, she just kind of wants to be solid, and she sees it not being perfectly solid as he shows up, and is just a little bit more concerned about that than, mm-hmm. you know, than she maybe hoped.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that read.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Again, just to the credence and the credit of what we talked about in the wrap up, I think that Artie is a very strongly written character, one of whom is kind of trapped in a lot of ways. And I think that this is like the first time that she's really exposed fully her like inner thoughts to someone that isn't West, West gets a lot of it in general, in part because of his place in their relationship and sort of both being a sibling and an abuser. There's something there, of course, that he just gets an honest front because they've grown up together. But this is the first time someone else has really seen behind the curtain. You could argue Glockta has to some extent, but not to the same degree.
In a measured way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a specific way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Anything else on Jizzal and Ardy?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I wanted to bring up, there is sort of like a bitter irony when you compare Farrow and Logan to Jizzal and Ardy, right? Like Farrow and Logan desperately like kind of want to be together, but can't communicate as such. And Jizzal and Ardy are being together despite maybe communicating that it's not the best idea for themselves in this immediate moment, right? So there's like a little bit of that distance gap. This is reading into the lie being an actual lie, not like how we're reading it, but mm-hmm. there is some nice dichotomy there.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I wish I could say that I think Logan being here to impart some fatherly wisdom upon Jizzal would be good, but I don't think it'd be particularly helpful.
I don't think it would have good advice here. Right. Yeah, I don't think it would do that much for him, to your point. Yeah. Right. All right, cool. With that, let's go to our final chapter of the week. Feeding time.
Feeding time.
Dear Glockta, do you like feeding the ducks? Personally, I think feeding the ducks is the greatest thing in the world. What are your thoughts on this subject? Your friend, Lord Wetterlent. Well, Mr. Wetterlent.
These graphics are amazing.
These graphics are so cool. I couldn't help it. I read this chapter for whatever reason this afternoon as I was going through and doing the notes again. And I was like, this is Strong Bad Emails, the chapter. Oh, God.
To answer your question, no. I think that feeding the ducks creates unnecessary dependency. And we should strive to foster a society where ducks feed themselves.
I don't disagree. You almost went like Mitch Hedberg there, which Mitch Hedberg has a joke about feeding ducks
Ducks love sun chips.
Ducks, give me some sun chips. I wonder if three ducks in a trench coat can walk into a Subway. I need bread for those ducks.
You get bread for free from Subway if you're a duck.
Yeah.
So throughout this entire chapter, I love the symbolism of the ducks. And it's laid out so plainly and so like obviously right at the end, saying like he's enjoying watching the ducks fight one another or whatever he says. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
it felt good. I liked it.
Yeah, it felt very good. I hope everyone appreciated my niche early 2000s reference. I know a number of things by heart. The thing that I know the most correctly by heart is that entire 40-second Strong Bad email clip. I repeat it all the time to myself. I say it all the time. It's a familial thing. There's a photo of my entire family dressed up in Strong Bad masks one Christmas. And by entire family, I mean 20 people in hand-sewn Strong Bad masks. So
I used to watch Strong Bad emails all the time at swim meets when I was like a little kid.
Amazing.
My buddy and I would watch them. I think it was like the fourth generation iPad, or not iPad, iPod Nanos, like the squat fat ones that could actually like play video. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was one of those. And we would load all the Strong Bad emails on because I learned how to use
they were all available.
Handbrake and rip them from.
Oh, you handbroke them? They had them for download.
Maybe it was. Maybe that was it. I can't remember. I just remember like getting them onto my iPod and watching them under the bleachers at swim meets.
Yeah. We just to kind of curtail the side tangent a little bit and put a bow on it. We used to watch my family. Parents are divorced, and so every other week we'd go between houses. And Mondays were the day where we would switch. And every Monday we would watch Strong Bad emails in my dad's place, regardless whether it was Monday morning when we were before school or Monday night when we came back to his place. So we never missed a Strong Bad email release day ever for the duration of Strong Bad emails. So
there's a lot
sometimes they missed. There's like 700-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few hundred. Well, I guess I'm also including like other skits and stuff like that. But Strong Bad emails were always Monday consistently for years, with a handful of exceptions and some skipped weeks here and there. But oh man, I love nothing more than a good Strong Bad email. Once in a while, they'll put out a new one, or they'll put out, you know, like refreshers on the old website, and I'll be like, yes,
my precious. I didn't know they were keeping up with it at all.
Yeah, they still do stuff. Also, they ran for a long time a Twitter page, and now since they've migrated to Instagram and a little bit to Threads, and they tweet in Strong Bad's voice all the time and like write in his character. Oh, it's so good. I don't know. My original comedic interest lies entirely in Strong Bad.
The only sentence you could have said that could remotely convince me to join Threads.
is Strong Bad tweets?
Yeah.
Basically? Yeah. Cool.
I still won't, but
yeah, good call. Close. Good call. As someone of whom is now actively trying to Threads, I recommend you don't for your own sanity.
All right, get back to the book.
Anyway, now that we've taken that side tangent in the middle of our episode. Actually, though, I love this scene. As you'd mentioned, it's very straightforward. It's cut and dry in a lot of different ways. Glockta is attempting to meet as discreetly as possible to Park as he possibly can with as many lords. This time we're meeting with Lord Wetterlint. He attempts to bribe him, but misses the marks count in a lot of cases of what he's already been paid or offered, including 15,000 marks, 18,000 marks, hunting grounds plus 18,000 marks, and then 25,000 marks by Morovia. And so all of these different offers, and he offers to match that highest bid, which is Morovia's, to potentially receive the number of bids from him, all the while the squabbling ducks fight over bits of bread.
Yeah. The fact that, like, this guy knows what he's doing. He's stringing him along. He's, like, giving him the next highest bid. And then revealing a little bit later, oh, there's another one. I believe, because he's dropping the right names and everything, look, he knows the players, which maybe isn't that big of a deal to know. Now that I think about it, he doesn't actually know Morovia's like inside man's name until Glockta mentions it. So like, it's conceivable to me that he is straight up playing Glockta and acting like he has all these other offers on the table. To try to get, like, just to try to squeeze as much as he can out of him seems like a pretty well-versed man in the dark dealings of statecraft. I don't know, just the fact that Morovia's agent comes up again as, like, the primary rival tells me maybe he's telling the truth, but I could see it being a bluff. Yeah,
we haven't said his name either over the course of this, but his name is Harlan Morrow.
Yeah, I didn't say his name because I couldn't remember his name.
I got it. And he was originally brought up as a part of the whole thing. He was deputy to Lord Chamberlain Hoff in the first book.
Gotcha. Okay.
So he was the one who was doing a lot of introductions.
As something that had been said before.
Yeah. Yeah. He's been around, but not, you know, omnipresent by any stretch.
Yeah, between the fact that he like put Morovia on top and the reference to the duck squabbling, it makes me think like there's actually offers on the table here, and he's just kind of a bastard playing at like negotiations. But
well, on top of that, they don't have anything on it, right? Like, this is a straight bribe. This is just a bribe.
Yeah,
there's no confession. There's no nothing else. Yeah. I said for 5 total votes, it is 4 total votes. That was my bad. I thought it was 4+1. It's 3+1.
Yeah. I couldn't remember if it was 4 additional or 4 including his own.
All right. With that, we've got our final little bit of the chapter here. Glockta returns to Ardy's place and is met by Jizal, just leaving, of whom congratulates him on his promotion before bumping out of the way. Glockta comes into the house and attempts to scold Ardy for her behavior, but she pushes right back, citing him as far worse in his own time. This is such an interesting conversation that happens between kind of both pairs, right? First, Glockta and Jizal, both being winners of the contest, being servants in the king's own, and then also Ardy and Glockta from the other side, the personal relationship side. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of confronting two different halves of Glockta's personality or prior personality at once, which is interesting.
Yeah. I've been trying to figure out for a while sort of an analog to Glockta and Artie's relationship. And at least from Glockta's perspective now, it's starting to come out of the fog in my mind a little bit as more of a parental relationship than anything else, as opposed to someone pining over someone who he probably won't end up with. It feels more like he's taken on a parental sort of station above Artie. Not above, yeah. But for Artie in a way.
Stepdad, maybe, or something that's akin therein.
I mean, it's like, it's not a perfect right.
I would even say like older brother that isn't West.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like somewhere that. Between those two things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an uncle maybe is maybe more accurate, where it's not quite as scolding as a parent is, but it's also not quite as like friendly as a sibling would be generally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere in there. Yeah, he does definitely sit in that chair rather nicely, if not a bit uncomfortably because of his grotesqueries. But yeah, I do agree. It's interesting to see sort of the confrontation. I particularly appreciate Jizal's reaction to Glockta and the way in which he shakes his hand and congratulates him upon his promotion. That was just a moment that kind of again made me smile for our boy, being like, you know, you hated and were repulsed by this man and said you were shocked and impressed. And you kind of have a better understanding of not only how to confront people and meet them where they're at, but also a greater appreciation for the world and the people that are in it.
Yeah. He's becoming a real human.
He's a real guy. He's a real guy. He's just a little guy, but he's a real guy.
Yeah. Just a little guy.
Yeah. What did you make of sort of their like bickering about sort of the stasis of her in society and otherwise? Was there anything that kind of stood out to you on the front of, you know, like the way that Glockta reflects on the way that he kind of like emotionally manipulated women into different situations when he was younger, and like what that shapes up to be? I don't know. What were kind of your thoughts there?
I mean, she's astute and she, I don't know if she knows.
She's aware.
She's aware, but I think there's probably a fair deal of just assumption, and she's right. Like he was fairly stereotypical as a young man, but maybe we're missing context where he talked about his past life and sort of explained his exploits, but we didn't see that, so I'm gonna assume it didn't happen and she's just astute enough to understand like what kind of person he probably was.
Yeah, he does suggest a couple of things as he's thinking back to her fair point that she makes. He internally thinks she makes a fair point. Perhaps a soft word with the gentleman in question will do the trick. A soft word or a hard night with practical frost. As he kind of insulates and protects her, as West may want, you know, potentially.
Yeah.
Uncertain, you know, what exactly that is or means, but.
Yeah, just whatever Glockta understands his directive to be, which is looking after her, taking care of her. So
cool. All right. Anything else on this week, PJ?
I don't believe so.
Cool. All right. Well, sweet. We made good time on this one, which is great, of course. Just a reminder to everyone at home, given that we shifted this, I've yet to shift the internet calendar to match exactly, but next week we are going to be reading So Much in Common through Flower and Plaudits. Again, So Much in Common through Flower and Plaudits. Very excited to continue reading into this book. Because of sort of the next couple weeks that we have with like me being in Minnesota and otherwise and whatnot, I've slowed down kind of the pace of this first part. This is originally going to be two episodes. I'm turning it into three. So we'll go slow and then we'll go a little bit quicker here from a chapter perspective. Not too much, but a little bit. So very excited to continue reading this book, PJ. Yay.
Me too.
Yay. Other than that, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. You can hear us chat about both Dark Matter, and we rounded out Dark Matter 2 weeks ago or last week or whatever it was. And then also we've been covering the House of the Dragon. We've got a couple of shows that we're lining up for kind of additional coverage on the Patreon.
I'm liking, like, I maybe we'll hear some feedback. I think it's been received well, but I'm liking where we're at with the Devil's Cuts, with doing
PJ,
sort of
I'm
mini,
also
small
thinking
format things.
This is a crazy thing. We've been talking about it for a long time, but I'm thinking maybe we do our Devil's Cuts on video.
Oh, let's do it. Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
That might be the new way. Yeah.
I think that's perfect. Let's do that.
You heard it here first, folks. We make a lot of business decisions on air, and you just get to witness them.
Does that mean I have to get a camera?
You've got a camera. You're fine enough. This will be fine.
This one's all right. This has been a tried and true webcam for me for such a very long time.
4 years since we started the show.
This webcam I've had for like a decade.
Whoa, it's impressive, actually.
It's the Logitech 1080p one, which was like top of the line when I got it.
Yeah, but it looked pleasantly surprised. Yeah, yeah. Would have never imagined. I'm just rocking the MacBook camera. I'll set up my proper camera setup and everything that I've got going on and do it that way. But I've got a streaming camera, technically. I've just never bothered. It only cost me a couple $1,000s, but it's fine. I use it as a traditional camera.
Right. If you want to follow us on social media and hear more of this ridiculousness, or see Crossland post things on Threads, but not me, you can follow us at Words Whiskey Pod at pretty much everywhere. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 910-408-2534. Maybe I'll answer. That's an incentive. Maybe I'll just answer the phone call if you try to call that. But if you leave a voicemail, we'll probably play it on the show.
Yeah, we probably will play it on the show.
You'll notice that we haven't played any on the show since our 200th episode or whatever it was.
Yeah, we haven't. Man,
which means we haven't gotten any calls.
Which is fine.
It's okay. But you really can't, like, genuinely, if you're like, oh, that'd be kind of fun, but do it. I don't know.
No pressure, but also so much pressure. Also, as PJ mentioned, if you want to send us an email, feel free to do so. Just make sure that you send it properly and provide, at the very least, one gift certificate for Subway so that we can feed ducks. Because
no, they eat for free. Ducks eat for free at Subway.
I don't think so. I don't think anymore. I think that was an old policy. I don't think they eat for free.
Well, then I don't want to support them.
Out of date.
WordsandWhiskeyShow@gmail.com.
WordsandWhiskeyShow@gmail.com. You can find me on Threads as well, and or Words and Whiskey. I'm kind of going off of both variously at the moment. I'm also in the process. We're in the process of kind of revitalizing a lot of the different posts and things like that. You'll see some stuff coming out from us. We have a cool project that we've kind of got brewing in the background that I'm excited for, at the very least. Some people might like it. Some people might not. And you know what? I don't care if you do. But I hope you do.
It's been a lot of fun, regardless.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a ton of fun pairing a cocktail, an album, and a book together. So there's a little teaser for stuff that we have forthcoming on the social medias. So other than that, leave us a 5-star review. If you don't leave us a 5-star review, we'll leave you up in a tower, chained, your gut cut, your head cut off, and you're awful laying about.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that we were going to have a really bad sexual encounter with you. Regret our decisions.
That's just so much more, BJ. Why would I say that? Oh my God. Who do you think I am? That's so personal.
Someone that could deliver on that. I don't know.
Jesus. All right. We'll talk with you next week.